In 1935, the Loewenberg family was on vacation in Italy. While they were there, they learned that they and all Jewish people who lived in Germany had lost their German citizenship. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Hitler's decision to revoke Jewish citizenship set the Loewenberg family, including 7-year-old Gerhard, on a life-changing journey to the United States. Now, Gerhard Loewenberg, an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Iowa, has written about how that political event and 11 others influenced his life and career. His new memoir is Moved by Politics. I'll talk with him. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When he was 7 years old, Gerhard Loewenberg, or Jerry Loewenberg, was on vacation in Italy with his family. They learned from the newspaper about Hitler's decision to revoke Jewish citizenship, and that set the family on a journey that included a new life in America. Now, Gerhard Loewenberg, an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Iowa, has written about how that political event and other events influenced his life and his career in his new memoir, Moved by Politics, 12 Episodes in an Academic Life. And he is here with me today. Jerry, thank you so much for being here.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
And let's go back to when you were 7 years old. It was 1935. Your family was on vacation. Do you remember when your parents found out about that decision to revoke Jewish citizenship in Germany?
No, I don't remember when they found out. They found out from a newspaper in Italy where we were on vacation. But when we came back to Berlin at the end of that vacation, the first thing that I do remember very vividly is my mother saying to my grandmother, I don't intend to stay in this country.
And up until that point, I mean, your father was such a German patriot.
Right.
That must have been such a wrenching decision for them.
It absolutely was. You know, Jews reacted differently to the appointment of Hitler. Some of them immediately drew the conclusion that there was no future for them in Germany and left. But a relatively small proportion of people took that radical step. And when you try to reconstruct it, it is a difficult decision to decide just because there is a political upheaval, you leave the country in which you've lived for generations. So relatively few people left immediately. And then in succeeding years, different families and different people drew their conclusion from different events. And my father, as you say, having been a patriot and having fought for the country in the First World War, drew the conclusion that he wouldn't stay in a country where he couldn't be a citizen.
You had a little sister, too.
Yes.
How much younger is
she?
Two
years.
2 years younger.
And I still have her.
Yes, good. So she was five-ish and you were seven when this happened. And did your parents shield you from what was going on politically?
I don't think we needed much shielding. We lived in a very secure environment, in a very stable family. And when I try to reconstruct it, my parents decided to leave us in Germany with my grandmother so that they could settle in the United States and find a place to live and restart their careers. And we weren't, at least I wasn't, at all disturbed by that. I loved my grandmother and I was starting school and I didn't need much shielding. I didn't get any shielding. I wasn't worried.
There were some ways that your life changed that now when you look back, you can realize that there were changes because of the way Jews were being treated in Germany at that time. What were some of those changes?
I don't remember much. I mean, these are childhood memories. I remember that I wasn't allowed to sit in certain places in public parks. I remember that there were an awful lot of parades and flags. I remember that there was a lot of patriotic music, but I wasn't much affected. I was taking swimming lessons, and I remember being told on the last day of my lessons that I could no longer swim in that particular pool. But these were pretty trivial events. Nothing untoward was happening to me as a child. Undoubtedly, my parents did shield me, but my memory is not of scary events.
They did enroll you in a different school in the hopes that that would be a more positive experience.
Sent me
for you.
To a private school where the students were all Jewish, and they were afraid that if I went to a public school, I'd be harassed or teased. But I didn't know the difference between private and public schools, and so that made no difference to me. I should say that German Jews were fortunate in the fact that persecution began gradually and increasingly over a period of about 6 years, very differently from the persecution of Jews that began suddenly in most Eastern European countries. So German Jews had about 6 years to figure out what was going on and to react to it in different ways.
If they had the means.
Correct, if they had the means.
And your parents did have the means. Both of your parents were doctors?
Yes, my mother had never practiced. My mother had a doctor's degree, a degree as a physician, but she hadn't practiced. My parents were middle-class people who were tolerably well-off, and so they had the means in the sense of having the savings that enabled them to buy ship tickets for us and to start a new life in the United States. They gradually ran out of money, but gradually.
You write about some of the precautions that they took to make their money go as far as it possibly could. And some of these details are wonderful. And clearly your parents were planners.
Yes.
They were thinking far, far ahead.
Yes.
And they were concerned because when they would leave Germany and travel to the United States, if they exchanged a lot of money, they would really lose the value of that money, right?
Yes. The German government imposed, first of all, a severe tax for leaving. And then second of all, compelled families to convert their German currency into foreign currencies at a rate of, as I was told, 3-to-1. So my parents lost 2/3 of their savings. So they came to the United States with a small amount of money, and they knew it had to last because they weren't quite certain whether they could make a living. Even though they were both physicians, it was the midst of the Depression in the United States.
They didn't speak English before they came
here,
they
didn't speak much English. And they went to school to learn English. And they didn't know what would happen. So we learned frugality. And I'm often reminded that the frugality we practiced and the planning we practiced is not all that different from Iowa families in the Depression who similarly had to stretch to make ends meet. And the stories that Iowa families tell are not too different from the stories that refugee families tell in the Depression. We were in some respects similarly affected by the economic circumstances.
Your parents bought passage on the steamer that you would cross the ocean on before exchanging their money. They took some other precautions to make sure that they could buy some things that you would need, like furnishings for your apartment in America.
And even worse, German clothes. They bought enough clothes to last us for 3 or 4 years. And so we were stuck, my sister and I, wearing German clothes and being roundly teased by our friends for looking funny.
How were the German clothes you wore as a child different from what your friends were wearing?
Well, for example, German boys wore shorts. American boys wore knickers. German boys wore white button-down shirts. American boys wore more casual shirts. American boys had rubber-coated raincoats, which were just marvelous, and I had some kind of a cloth raincoat that made me look like a little doll, I suppose. And I was teased.
Yeah.
The clothes lasted forever because they had taken 2 or 3 years of clothes with us.
Which was wonderful foresight.
Yes.
but not
a little
for
difficult
an 8 or 9
adaptation.
Years old. Right. So how long were your parents in the United States before they sent for you and your sister?
6 months, half a year. We didn't have much contact with them. You know, it was the day before transatlantic telephone was at all used. It existed, wasn't used. So we exchanged letters occasionally, but I wasn't yet a letter-writing person. And I had very little contact.
And your sister less so.
Right. But I was really confident, because I kept being told this, that you're going to go to America sometime soon. But meanwhile, I wasn't too worried. In fact, I began to be interested in the United States and in New York and the buildings and the movie stars. And I was looking forward to it.
Had you had other members of your family, cousins, aunts, uncles, leave Germany as well?
Yes, my closest uncle and his family, my cousins, left at about the same time, but they left for England, didn't come to the United States. I had an uncle who already was in the United States. There was some family in the United States, but a lot of the members of my family and our friends were staying in Germany. And I remember, what I do remember is the railroad station on the day we left, there were possibly 20 people wishing us well and bringing us presents and making it seem as if we were going on a long trip. And they were kind of sending us off with candy and a camera and a couple of toys and said, have a good time.
Well, and you received a diary.
And I received a diary.
That you wrote in, although not very expressively.
That's right. It shows me to be a person lacking in imagination, being primarily interested in travel arrangements, timetables, schedules. So that diary, which I still have, says things like, we left at 9 o'clock and we were in an overnight train and then we took a boat over the channel and things of that sort.
Well, your mother traveled to England to meet you.
Right.
And to travel to the United States
right.
with you. And I love what you recorded of your reaction to seeing her again.
Yeah, it was a kind of a deadpan reaction. It was sort of the feeling, there's my mother, I remember her. And that's what I wrote.
She looks like I remember.
Yes. It was not startling and it was not emotional. It was kind of a matter of fact. And I suppose I was that kind of a person, a kind of a matter of fact person. Different children react differently to events of that
right.
sort.
And you wrote the same thing when you arrived in America and you saw your father. He looks the same as I remember.
Right.
What do you remember about that journey?
I loved it. It was very exciting to be on a transatlantic steamer. Wonderful food, as I remember it, roaming the decks, looking out at the endless ocean, very dramatic, being allowed to go to the movies, perhaps for the first time. It was a wonderful adventure, just marvelous.
And your mother encouraged you to try cornflakes because that's what children eat in America.
Yes. I found a very strange breakfast.
Were you scared? Were you nervous at all?
I don't remember that I was nervous at all. I was excited about coming to New York. I by then knew the names of the skyscrapers. I knew something about the streets. I was very anxious to see it. My impression is, for me, it was an adventure, something I was looking forward to. And it was every bit as exciting and as stimulating as I imagined as a little child.
I'm talking to Jerry Loewenberg. He's an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Iowa, and he's written about his life and his career in academia. His new memoir is called Moved by Politics, 12 Episodes in an Academic Life. And we're talking about how his family was displaced in the lead-up to World War II. And if your family has a similar history, if you came to the United States because of a political event in your home country, we'd love to hear your story this hour as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Gerhard Loewenberg, Jerry Loewenberg. He's an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Iowa. He's written about his life and his academic career in a new memoir called Moved by Politics, 12 Episodes in an Academic Life. And we're talking about how his family was set off on a journey to America because of the events leading up to World War II in Hitler's Germany. And a little later on, I'll also talk to Dr. Hani Alkadi, who was displaced. He is from Egypt, and he was displaced in the early 80s because of political events there. And if you have a similar story in your background, if your family or you were displaced by political events in your home country, we'd like to hear your story as well. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send your email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jerry, it's so interesting to hear about these events from the perspective of someone who was in first and second grade when you made that journey, when your family decided that they needed to leave Germany and you said goodbye to everything that was familiar and moved to the United States. Because listening to a child's eye perspective on it, it gives us such a different window into those events.
Yes, and I think I was extraordinarily fortunate compared to most of my compatriots in the circumstances under which we came to this country. They were the circumstances in which I didn't feel threatened, in which I found much excitement and stimulation in what was happening, and it was more an adventure for me personally than anything else. I was, of course, aware in the background that things were happening which had great consequence, and I think in the long run that affected my professional interests in politics and my career in many, many ways. But at that moment, I didn't have any inkling that the influence would be that great.
You came at a very good time in your life, I think, and in your sister's life. You write about how quickly the two of you adapted to life in the United States, how quickly you learned the language and made friends.
Yes. Yes, it's easy when you're seven to learn the language. It's easy to pronounce the new language correctly. It's easy to make friends, and adaptation at seven is a very different proposition from adaptation even 5 or 6 years later than that.
Right. You have cousins who came when they were older who always retained a German accent,
yes,
right?
Yes. We noticed immediately that if you were 10 or 11 or 12, you wouldn't lose your German accent. And altogether, adaptation was more difficult. When you're seven, you barely have a year or two of consciousness of what your life has been like. That isn't very much.
Your parents had a harder time, I think, adjusting to life in the United States. Of course, as adults, learning a language is much more difficult.
Yes.
But you mentioned it was the Depression. So
yes.
Getting a job is much more difficult, even though they were both doctors. They actually had to work for free in an effort to try to build a practice, right?
Yes. Yes, and that's so interesting. They had to work for free in hospitals in order to establish a reputation, in order to have the privilege, as it was called, of having patients in these hospitals. And they had to gradually develop private practices. As I said earlier, my mother had never practiced medicine before, although she had a degree, medical degree. So she was starting her career from scratch. My father had practiced medicine for 10 years and had something of a research career before that. And it was difficult because in the Depression, the competition among American physicians for patients was intense, and patients couldn't pay. And one of my earliest recollections is typing letters for my father to patients asking them to pay their bills.
Your family depended on you a lot, not just for your English language skills, but you also became master of the subway pretty quickly.
That's right. That was another fortunate thing. I was left alone. I was allowed to roam New York to a considerable extent because my parents didn't really have time, and my parents could, you say, depended upon me. They did find me a reliable guide to the subway system and the bus system. And as successive waves of my family and friends from Germany arrived in New York, I was the one to show them around the city. And that meant that I didn't have the experience of having hovering parents, but just the opposite, parents who gave me a great deal of freedom. And I didn't get into any trouble. It was, again, a continuation of an adventure.
You write about your fascination with the World's Fair in New York, and you went to the World's Fair by yourself repeatedly. How old would you have been then?
Well, it's clear that I was 10, which is amazing when you think back on it, because the World's Fair was three quarters of an hour away from where we lived and took two subway rides to get there. And I can't imagine why my parents let me do that. But we've already said they didn't have an awful lot of time to hover over either my sister or me. And I must have inspired some confidence that I was able to do that. The World's Fair was a huge event for a lot of people of my generation. And there are quite a few books by famous authors who have described their experience in the World's Fair. So I was not the only one. And the public schools in New York encouraged young people to go to the World's Fair and gave us very cheap tickets, a book of 20 tickets for $2. That was irresistible. And so I went often, and I learned a lot, and I had a very good time. And what it meant was that I would get up after breakfast and take the subway to the World's Fair and spend the whole day there, essentially, and come home.
Now, of course, at the time you were growing up in New York City, there was a world war going on, and it affected a lot of people that you knew and cared about in Germany. And of course, you were hearing about people that lived close to you in New York who were being affected as well. When you were at school, they were talking about alumni that were fighting or had fallen in the war. How closely did you, as a kid, follow those events?
More and more closely. The first event that brought home the persecution of the Jews was the Night of the Broken Glass, Kristallnacht, where the Nazi government began to harass Jews in a very serious and physical way, burned synagogues, put people in concentration camps. And I became aware that that was happening, and I became aware of the fact that my parents were terribly worried. So that this six-year period I described earlier, in which the persecution of the Jews developed gradually, reached its height in 1938 and 1939. To be specific about the years, the World's Fair started in April of 1939. The United States was not yet in the war. The European War started at the end of that year in September of 1939. So the World's Fair was the last event in a world which was not yet at war. But the prospect of war and the inevitability of war became certainly clear to my parents. And approximately half of the Jewish population of Germany never made it out. So most of my family, but not all, eventually arrived in the United States or elsewhere. But some did not survive. And the serious consequences of that became evident to me when I was an early teenager, I would say. And when the United States entered the war in 1941, I was 13, early teenage.
And your parents were worried about your future because there was a good chance that you could be drafted when you were of age.
In fact, very likely, yes. And they became then aware of the fact that if the war continued as it was likely to continue until I was of age to be drafted, I would get involved in the war, and they wanted to accelerate my education so that I would at least finish high school before I would be drafted.
And you did. You finished high school at age 16.
I finished high school, yes, at age 16, and that again was a very fortunate coincidence because the war ended in 1945, when I was 16, the war in Europe ended. The war in Japan ended at the end of 1945. I was not yet 17, so I was not drafted. I did not have to fight in the war. I escaped that also. It's another element of the good fortune that I had early in my life and all my life.
You went off to college at age 16, and that's, you know, it's hard to imagine a 10-year-old roaming the World's Fair by themselves. It's also hard from today's perspective to imagine a 16-year-old going off to college by yourself, finding your own lodgings. And
that's also so different. My parents didn't know much about colleges. They knew about Cornell University because my father was a physician, and Cornell University had a medical college in New York, and he knew this was a good institution. So they sent me off on a Greyhound bus on an overnight trip and had confidence that I would find a place to live and I could start college by myself. And they sent a trunk after me with whatever belongings I would need in college. And that is very different from what it is now.
When you were a child, you thought that you would be a scientist. As you grew, you became attracted to politics and journalism. So when you went off to school, you thought you would become a journalist, which
yes.
Some of your family members thought, well, that doesn't even take training.
Right, right.
But what drew you into the world of political science?
Well, that background of awareness of the importance of politics in people's lives certainly had a lot to do with it. That awareness of what had happened to democracy in Germany had a lot to do with it. And although I thought of being a scientist, as you say, in high school, I began to realize that my concept, child's concept of science, is very different from an adult's career in science. And meanwhile, I had some very good teachers in history, particularly in high school. And that set the stage for my thinking, maybe science is not for me, maybe history is for me. And you don't have something called political science in high school. But when I went to college, I saw that political science was an aspect of history, political history, and I became very interested in that. And then a series of events pushed me in that direction, including a roommate who was convinced that this was the subject of study.
You write about beginning your academic career, and you went on to get your PhD. You went straight through, and before you had actually officially received your PhD, you were looking for an academic post, and you found one at Mount Holyoke University in Massachusetts. You're newly married, yes. And you write about how much money you made, and it's it's not good.
No, it was hard to start an academic career. I was by then convinced that that's what I wanted to do. And my parents were skeptical that I could make a living. And my uncle was extremely skeptical and told me I would starve. He wanted me to work in his company. And I was determined to do that nevertheless. And I started this memoir really in an endeavor to encourage today's graduate students to realize that the career can be difficult to start, but can nevertheless succeed. And it was out of solicitude for this generation of graduate students that I wrote that first episode about getting a job. And that then developed into other episodes of events that started various aspects of my life.
As you progressed in academia and decided that you wanted to do some serious research, one of the things that you researched was the democratization of Germany in the post-war world. And in so many ways, it seems like you were the perfect person to do that kind of research because you had this German background. You spoke the language, although not on an academic level, as you point out. That was frustrating to you when you traveled to Germany. But the fact that you had left Germany before the war, before the discrimination, before the persecution had really taken a toll on you, I think it made it possible for you to explore Germany in a way that few others could have.
I think that's absolutely right. And it was my attempt to understand what had happened there that really gave focus to my career as a political scientist, as you rightly say. I then was determined to try to uncover how a democracy can unravel the way German democracy did and how it can be rebuilt. And a large part of the research that I've done throughout my career has dealt with first German democratization and then democratization altogether, and eventually gave me a focus on legislatures because I found that democratic legislatures are key institutions for the preservation of democracy and for the stability of democracy.
I want to bring a caller into the conversation. If you could slip on your headphones, Jerry. Mary is on the line from Iowa City. Hello, Mary.
Oh, good morning.
Hi there.
I like the way your Dr. Lewenberg is speaking because his narrative reminds me so much of the slave narrative, where you come from oppression to freedom and how you become an American. And I find it very fascinating.
You know, Mary, it's so interesting because yesterday on the show I was talking with novelist Ayanna Mathis, and her novel takes place, the beginning, at least during the Great Migration. And so in reading Professor Lewenberg's book, I was thinking about that a lot, the similarities between the Great Migration from the South to the North for African Americans in this country and Jews leaving Germany.
That's absolutely true. There is a clear parallel, and Jewish history has a parallel altogether, because the enslavement of Jews in Egypt and the liberation of Jews in Egypt is one of the great stories of Jewish history and makes Jews particularly sensitive to what African Americans have experienced in a much later age.
And I like, I'm going to get your book, but I know you're going to teach a class at the Senior Center.
Yes.
And I'm going to. I have already signed up for it.
Oh, that's wonderful! I look forward to meeting you.
Oh, thank you very much,
Mary. Thank you so much for your call, Jerry. What brought you to Iowa?
That's an interesting story too, because I didn't know much about Iowa at all in the 1960s, and I tell a story in this book where I was looking for a graduate student I knew to be at the University of Iowa, and drove on Interstate 80 right by Iowa City to Ames, not knowing that there were two universities with very similar names in Iowa.
A typical Easterner, Jerry.
A typical Easterner. Didn't know what was going on. although I must say the similarity of the names of the institutions could confuse a lot of people, the University of Iowa in Iowa City and the State University of Iowa in Ames. Anyway, I missed him. And that was the end of that for the moment. But curiously enough, a couple of years later, he wrote me and said, you know, this is really a great place. You ought to come and visit. And not only that, but there are new people in the department who are interested in legislatures, as you are, and why don't you come out and give a lecture? And I did. And I found Iowa City completely different from what I expected it to be. Lovely, attractive, the university really imposing, very, very impressive. And I put in the back of my mind the notion that maybe this would be a place in which to have a career. And I came back for another visit. And then the chairman of the department, who was very welcoming, said to me, why don't you come out for an even longer visit for 1 year? And my wife and I thought, that's a really good way to become acquainted. And so we learned about Iowa by stages and learned to love it and have spent more than half of our lives here.
And we're happy to have you here. We're going to take another short break. With me right now, Gerhard Loewenberg. He's an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Iowa. He's written a book about political events and how they've driven his life and his life in academia. His memoir is called Moved by Politics, 12 Episodes in an Academic Life. Coming up in just a moment, we'll also talk with Dr. Hani El-Khadi, who was displaced from his home in Egypt by political events in the early 1980s. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking today with Gerhard Loewenberg. He's an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Iowa. He's written about his life in academia in a new memoir called Moved by Politics, 12 Episodes in an Academic Life. And this hour, we've been talking about the political events that set him on his life's journey, the political events in Germany in the early 1930s that sent his family to the United States. And we've been talking also about other political movements that have displaced people around the world. And if that's your story or your family's story, we'd love to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call to be a part of the conversation. And now joining us is Dr. Hani El-Khadi, and he has experienced this kind of journey as well, although a very different tale. Dr. El-Khadi, you were born in Turkey, but you grew up in Egypt, right?
Well, it's an honor to be talking on your radio on the air today. And I'm so privileged to be in
the company of a famous
character like our professor here, who's a remarkable guy, although I don't know him as I know his wife, because we both share interest in arts. And she's a pioneer in this community, in this area. So I'm so happy to hear that. As a matter of fact, my story is not so much different because, again, it's a political turmoil that pushes people out of their home and they seek refuge somewhere else. You know, this can be so far away from parents and from brothers. But my life was not an easy one. I had difficult childhood under wars and dictatorship and abuse, torture, arrest, and so forth. So when I got ready to leave, it was a peaceful atmosphere in Egypt. There was a president who was seeking to establish peace with people who used to be called adversarial or enemies. But unfortunately, that didn't culminate or didn't result in a very positive.
You first came to the United States. In Egypt, you were a surgeon and a professor of medicine.
I was a surgeon in Egypt for a while and the United Nations in Africa and Southeast Asia before I went to London to get my fellowship in surgery, yes.
And you were invited to the United States first, invited to Iowa City first as part of the International Writing Program.
This is probably why the luck plays a role here. because I was lucky. I was one of the supportive people for the peace. And, of course, this can put you in a camp in Egypt that you are an enemy of the state or an enemy of the intelligentsia. There was a lot of hate that was based on really fundamentalist approaches to thoughts and to philosophy and political actions and so forth. So, but I was lucky to meet one of my heroes, who is a famous poet from Massachusetts, the late Stanley Kunitz, who I had translated all his work to various languages in the Middle East. And he came to the Middle East in a tour, and he heard about this little guy who translated him, and he was astonished because he writes in a surrealistic style, which is extremely difficult to translate.
Right, surreal poetry.
He asked the people in the embassy to reverse the translation in order to test, to see if I have succeeded to catch the spirit of his work or not. And he said, I'm so impressed, I'm going to call a friend of mine. His name is Paul Engel in Iowa City. I didn't know much about Iowa at all. For me, Iowa is Idaho, is Ohio. They're all the same. So I was lucky because I was invited to come to the writer's workshop and from here on.
When your time in Iowa City was over, you returned to Egypt.
Yes.
What happened to you then?
That was a real difficult time when I was either to accept staying there and being arrested or tortured, because the new system was very confused. Hosni Mubarak took over after the assassination, the brutal assassination of President Sadat, whom was my friend, and I knew him personally very well. And he was one of my best readers, too. Mubarak was brutal against all the people that knew his predecessor and tried to appeal to the general Arab, you can say, feeling by striking all the friends of the peace process at the beginning before he rectified himself. But that was time when my passport was suspended. I was called to the security, which is called Mabahs, there every other day. I had an American wife who happened to be a daughter of another pioneer, a friend of Dr. Lundberg, by the way, Dr. Janusz Bardak, who is an eminent plastic surgeon in the world, from the Jews who were really persecuted in Germany and in Russia. So it was all combined factors, and eventually I was saved, you know.
And your life was very much in danger.
Very much so, yeah.
You came to the United States, you came back to Iowa City, and there's an interesting parallel in the two of your stories, and Jerry, your parents were physicians in Germany. They came to the United States. And because they came when they did, they were able to practice as physicians. But, of course, physicians from all over the world often emigrate to the United States and find that they are no longer physicians. They can't practice medicine in the United States without a number of years more education. What did you think you would do when you moved here permanently?
Well, I had no intention to pursue a career in medicine. I was lucky that I was accepted in medicine, and I passed a couple of tests, and I got an appointment in the University of Iowa College of Medicine. I started to teach, too, in two departments, surgery and anatomy. But that was not my cup of tea, to be honest with you. It was my duty as a human being to do that. I loved doing that because you give and you keep giving and giving. And I was one of the people from the idealistic generation of the late baby boomers who thought, well, this is the best way to go and get injured and go to war and save the poor and save the needy and so forth. So it wasn't really my cup of tea. I wanted to do, that's why I came to the writer's workshop to study English, syntax and grammar, and how to express myself by writing, write poetry in English and so forth. So that was my intention, in addition to, of course, my background in art.
And you became an art teacher eventually, yes, in the United States, in
yes,
Iowa City.
You see, with a lot of injuries that I had and a lot of wounds that afflicted my physique, I had to do that because I was not ready to receive good salary and have great income at a time when I'm not really 100% sure what I'm doing, especially my area was transplant surgery. And this is a very meticulous area. You have to have good vision, good legs, and everything in my body was broken somehow. My vision was not good, and I had to sit with my wife, who is a wonderful lady, Eva Bardak, and she said, go ahead. I said, but you married the doctor, and now you're going to marry a vagabond. And she said, I don't care. I married a man, and you have all my support. And to this moment, I'll never forget that a woman stand by her husband when he loses the
everything,
big bucks, and,
yeah,
and now he's in. And somebody suggested that I do art, and I did art for a while, and eventually ended up teaching in high school.
And I know that your career as a teacher touched many, many students. You were a much loved and inspirational teacher for many students in Iowa City. I've heard a few of those stories. But I wonder, since we're talking today about people who are displaced by political movements, if you can tell me what, you know, we are a nation of immigrants. Many of us, our families, our grandparents, our great-grandparents came here because of something in their home country that really drove them away. Jerry, what would you want young people to understand about your experience and Hani's experience and their own family's experience to know what that means about America?
Well, what it means about America to me is that it is a country which is able to assimilate people of diverse backgrounds and diverse values and become a stronger nation as a result of it. And in a sense, that makes the United States a symbol of the world that is developing as a result of population movements that are occurring, not just from other countries to the United States, but among many of the countries of the world. The capacity of the United States to get the best out of succeeding waves of immigrants and to become a nation that is a multi-ethnic nation is an example to what other nations in the world must also learn.
Right now, of course, there are a lot of people debating immigration policy in the United States.
Yes.
With all that is going on in different parts of the world, how do you feel about immigration policy in the United States? In many ways, this is not a safe haven because it's difficult for people to get here.
Well, in American history, there have been changes from time to time in the attitudes, mm-hmm, toward immigration. There have been obstacles to immigration. There have been walls raised against certain types of people and certain waves of immigration. And it was not clear that my family, for example, would be able to come to the United States because there were quotas for people from Germany, for example, that you had to contend with. So this has a long history, and it's not easy to say what the policy of the government should be at any given moment. But basically welcoming waves of immigrants has been the success story of the United States.
Dr. El-Khadi, you spent many years teaching high school students. Did you tell them your story? I know you were teaching them art, but did you talk to them about what you had been through and what brought you here?
My choice for teaching was to teach kids who are labeled at risk, which is a term that I don't approve. But I thought, with a difficult childhood where I lost a good part of my family at war, And I became dispossessed and a refugee. There was no hope. Ended up in jail because I was trying to do something against the government that's brutal and dictatorship. When I was in jail, I was 9 years old. And I was thrown into a cell because I was smuggling weapons across the border and things like that. I was used differently by some people who were older than me, but anyway, I believed in the cause. I believed in the noble part of it, that we have to get rid of these people. And so it was a difficult childhood where you lose hope completely. And so my curriculum was my own narrative, my own story. And I discovered something very amazing among the people who are dropouts or in despair or who are left over or forgotten. They have dysfunctional family or personal troubles, learning disabilities, exceptionality, and so forth. I found them amazingly. If they find somebody who can understand them, listen to them, motivate them, they can be amazingly achievers. And they are my friends, they are my buddies now, and all of them, I say a lot of them are extremely successful everywhere. And I'm so proud that this country, even as Professor Lundberg was saying, you know, with all richness and treasure of immigrants, can really deal with the most difficult part of this generation. And I'm proud of this career. If I have to be proud of anything in my life, this will be my best time as a teacher for at-risk kids.
We received an email from Mike in Ames. Your story resonates with him, Jerry. He says, I have an aunt by marriage, now nearly 90 years old, who was a Jewish refugee from Germany. After years of hearing only bits and pieces of the story of her life and her family's migration to the U.S. when she was 14, I had the good fortune to ask her to tell us more about her experience several years ago. I'm extremely happy that this occurred while she was still here to tell the story. She had an experience several years ago of being included in an invitation for Jewish refugees to return for a remembrance to her hometown in Germany, where they discovered that a number of local Jews had been saved by a German army captain who, on a much smaller scale, was a sort of mini Oscar Schindler. And we're nearly out of time, but this is a moment in time where we need to collect the stories of people of your generation, because these stories are disappearing.
Yes, and I'm glad I had the opportunity to write the memoir that I did, because it's a part of this history. It's a fortunate part of the history. Dr. Alkadi's experience have been much, much more difficult. I want to add one word about the ability of the United States to assimilate a great variety of people. Nowhere is that done more successfully, it seems to me, than in the state of Iowa. The Iowa population has been particularly welcoming to the greatest diversity of individuals, not always without discrimination, but generally with an open-mindedness that is very inspiring.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Gerhard Loewenberg, Jerry Loewenberg, he's an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Iowa. His new book is called Moved by Politics, 12 Episodes in an Academic Life. And Dr. Hadi, thank you so much for being here today.
I am so honored to be in your company and the company of Jerry.
Well, thank you for telling your story. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally. This is Talk of Iowa.